You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.
My name is Deborah, like in the book of Judges, but I'm not a judge. I'm just an ordinary lawyer, and I'm kind of an interloper because I'm not an ACBC certified counselor. So maybe you wonder what in the world I'm doing here and why in the world they have a lawyer come and talk. Well, I've been hanging around these conferences since the early 90s. I spent the first 40 years of my life as a psychologized counselee looking for answers in all the wrong places, even as a Christian. And the last counselor that I ever saw left her profession and went into ministry. I got more out of her ministry than I ever got out of her therapy. And then she had the nerve to die of cancer and kind of left me at a crossroads. But I had heard her say that some of the psychology you have to learn to become licensed is diametrically opposed to the Bible. And since I knew that psychotherapy had always made my life worse and never better, I started to research the issue and read everything I could read. And in those days, you could still get J. Adams books in a Christian bookstore. So eventually, I lived in Southern California at the time. I discovered what is now the Institute for Biblical Counseling and Discipleship. And at the time, it was CCEF West, and George Scipione was operating it. So I started taking their classes, hanging around Westminster Seminary. So I enrolled in seminary and spent 6 years there, and then went on to law school. So God had quite a path for me and has done amazing things in my life. And when I started seminary, I also began doing volunteer work with abused children ministry. And that developed into a ministry. At the bottom of your outline, there's a website for that, resurrectionrabbit.com, music ministry to kids. And I also started to write critiques of psychology books, and there's a website on that, christiandiscernment.com. That's on your outline. So I have never gotten certified as a counselor, but I've been hanging around for 25 years. And after I got through with law school, eventually I started to come and speak on legal issues in biblical counseling. Now, the first time that I ever did that, J. Adams was still coming. He was still traveling, and he asked me what I was going to talk about. And I told him I was going to talk about how you can be sued as a biblical counselor. And he said, well, I'm not going to that one because I don't want to be sued. But what I try to help people do here is to avoid being sued so that your resources are not diverted to defending lawsuits. And instead, you can use your resources, your time, and your money to be able to minister to hurting people. My great passion as a lawyer, my primary expertise is constitutional law. Religious liberty, sanctity of life, free speech, things like that, and I've talked about those things in past years. And I set up and advise nonprofit corporations. So I don't do family law, but I do have a lot of good information for you, so don't leave, and some good resources. Usually I wait until the end to talk about resources, but today I want to start with some resources that have been really helpful to me to keep up with things, but they're also helpful to churches to keep up with issues, not only sexual abuse, but all kinds of issues. But this church law and tax report, I'm doing a little show and tell today. If you're listening on the tape, just get the name down. They have a ton of wonderful resources. They put out this very thorough report every 2 months about case law developments, legislation, and they have been really on top of this issue of sexual abuse and child abuse reporting. And most of what I want to talk about today is the child abuse reporting. But they have a resource that there's a list of them right here on the top of your outline. They used to be able to once a year, list put a chart with and that summarized the child abuse reporting laws in all 50 states. Well, now they have a separate resource that I brought with me. I don't have time to go through every single one of these. You can see how thick this is because they've included a page or two for each state. And at the end, there's a list of phone numbers and web resources. That resource is available on their website. The link is right here on your outline, and it's $14.95, so I spent the money and bought it, which means I couldn't copy it and distribute it to all of you, or I'd be violating some copyright laws. But afterwards, if anybody wants to come take a look at any of that, please do that. But they have some other things. They had something, 21 Facts Church Leaders Should Know About Child Abuse Reporting. That was a good resource. And I think I got that one for free. That was up there. And there's a link there. It's a long link, but you could probably find that and read it. So I highly recommend that resource. Couple of other things that I mentioned here too. The Alliance Defending Freedom. That is a Christian legal defense group. They represented the cake baker in the Supreme Court last year. We had a good decision on that, 7-2, he prevailed. So that's a good thing. So they do wonderful work all over the nation. And they have many allied attorneys like me who are not employed by them, but who are part of their network. So that's a very fine organization. And they've started something new, a church alliance that churches can join, and there's some cost to it, but it includes free legal representation. And I don't have all the details of that right now. It's very new. But next year, I'm going to talk about lining up your legal ducks. And I should have, by that time, hopefully we'll have more information on that. But there's also a little link on that. So if you want to find out more about that, that would be much more comprehensive than simply abuse reporting. It would include other issues. And there are a lot of legal issues that churches can face in this day and age. So you might check that out. The Christian Legal Society is a wonderful group too. I belong to that. And that's a membership group for Christian attorneys. And they're having their annual conference next week. And I usually go this year. I'm not able to, but they have a link on their website, or not a link, but a tab called Find a Lawyer. So if you want to find a lawyer in your particular state that does a certain kind of law, or even just a Christian lawyer, you can look on their website and get some names and where they're located and their phone numbers and emails. So that's a very good resource too. One of the things you should do in this whole area of abuse is have a local attorney on speed dial. There may be somebody in your congregation. A family lawyer would be a really good person to have, to know, to be able to ask specific questions about situations that might arise related to abuse. So that's a good resource. There are a couple of other things I want to recommend that are not on the outline that you might want to write down. I got an email recently about a sexual abuse summit on October 23rd. And it's in Fort Worth, but the live program sold out, but they're going to live stream on the internet. So if you're interested in that, it's go to ministrysafe.com. ministrysafe.com. That's the organization. And their website has some helpful things too. If you want to see the email that I got, you're welcome to email me and I can forward it to you. So that would be a good thing. And it's a training program. So if you want to say all of your biblical counselors at your church to watch that, or your children's ministry workers. A lot of what I have to say here about child abuse reporting is equally applicable to your children's ministry or nursery that you have at your churches. So there's that. And there's another group, the National Center for Life and Liberty, and they put on seminars for churches all across the country, and they cover a wide variety of issues, including abuse. But that website is ncll.org. So you might want to check that one out. Okay, child abuse reporting. I want to first mention the informed consent form that I've talked about other years. Some of you may have been to that. I've already spoken to one person who has. It's important for your counselees to know what you're doing in terms of biblical counseling rather than psychological counseling, and voluntarily consent to that so they know what they're getting into. And there are a couple of things I cover there that I want to specifically mention here. One is confidentiality. Unlike the psychotherapist, you can't promise absolute confidentiality because the Bible may require you to disclose something, Matthew 18, some church discipline situation. And the civil law may require you to report something. And a psychological counselor probably is also a mandatory reporter for child abuse, so that applies to everybody. But that's something that doesn't, paragraph wouldn't change because of this. I just wanted to highlight that. Reporting is kind of a double-edged sword, too, because if you don't report, and you should have, there are penalties, possible criminal penalties, lawsuits, civil penalties. So there's that. But as you probably know, too, an accusation that turns out to be false can do a huge amount of damage to someone's reputation. So you want to be careful. The standard is normally is if you need a reasonable suspicion of child abuse to have to report, well, what's reasonable and what isn't? And who do you believe and who don't you believe? It's a little subjective. So that takes some wisdom. Takes some wisdom. The other thing about the informed consent is that this is one time when you cannot confine the resolution of the matter to internal church procedures and church doctrine. I love to put something in the informed consent about biblical dispute resolution so that if you and the counselee have a conflict, the counselee agrees to resolve that within the church through biblically based mediation rather than a secular court. And of course, there's a biblical basis for that in 1 Corinthians 6. You don't want to take another Christian to court. But here, if there's child abuse, you've got to report. Now, you can hopefully cooperate with those authorities and maybe even make their job easier by your ministry to the family, maybe the person who's being abused or even the perpetrator. I remember a few years ago at one of these conferences, I think it was IBCD's in San Diego, I heard a pastor talk about being able to cooperate with state authorities and provide that continued biblical counseling, and really helps make their job simpler than it might be otherwise. But I remember that there was a case in California where two pastors wanted to handle an abuse situation with a stepfather and a child in a Christian school. They wanted to handle it internally, and they were hit with criminal penalties, and their free exercise of religion was not a defense. So this is one time when the First Amendment is not gonna cut it. That's important to know. Well, you're from many different states here. I met some of you ahead of time, and every single state in the country has a child abuse reporting law. Every single one. And this is not anything new. A lot of them were passed back in the 60s, some in the 70s, but now everybody's on board. And with the Me Too movement that I'm sure you haven't missed unless you're living under a rock, it's just an increasingly important issue that everybody is aware of. So you need to know your state law. Every state's a little bit different. So the overview that I'm going to do today, you know, I'm just be aware that there are nuances. Different states have a little bit different laws. So that's why it's important to know a lawyer in your state and to know what your state law requires. And a little slogan you might remember, when in doubt, check it out. If you think you might have to report something but you're not sure, you could make an anonymous call to the authorities, the agencies that takes those reports, or you can contact your lawyer if you've got one on hand and find out whether that's a situation that would require reporting. Okay. In order to overview these state laws, I've used a series of very familiar questions, who, what, when, where, why, and how, not necessarily in that order, because there's certain things you want to look for in your state law. The what question. What is abuse? Well, physical abuse is almost always on the list. Sexual abuse, I mean, those two things virtually always. And again, you've got to refine what is or isn't reportable, but those categories are always on there. States tend to include mental abuse, many of them. Some will say emotional abuse. And that's where it gets a little bit fuzzier, because what one person thinks is mental abuse, somebody else might not. I know Heath Lambert talked about that a little bit last night. So he had some good ideas as to what would qualify. But it's a little, can be tricky. And neglect is another thing. If a child is neglected, again, that can be very subjective. There's some clear-cut cases, but it can be very fuzzy. So that's the what. Then the who, and there's more than one who question here. Who is a victim for reporting purposes? Well, it's generally speaking a person under 18, a minor. And that's, I haven't seen any state where it's been defined any other way. But the reporting obligation might apply even if the victim is over 18 when you learn about the abuse. And that's where you've got to check out the specifics of state law. And there may be a statute about it. There might be a court case about it. And again, if in doubt, call and find out. And a reason you might want to, that might be important to do, is let's say that the perpetrator is still alive. And maybe the perpetrator has grandchildren, or maybe there may be other children, say, in the family of the perpetrator who would still be possibly subject to abuse. So you're protecting another generation then by reporting. So that's one reason to go ahead and do that. Who is a perpetrator for reporting purposes? Well, there's a lot of variation in state law. Sometimes it's limited to a custodial person, somebody that lives with the child, has responsibility or custody of the child, like a parent, a legal guardian, could be a foster parent or a caretaker. Could be a church or a school worker in some states. In some states, it's wide open, anybody. And usually doesn't apply if it's another minor, but again, you need to double check your state law. I mean, like if it's a 15 and 16 year old and it's something mutual, that's usually, I mean, that's a problem to be addressed for sure, but not necessarily a reportable event. But again, if there's a rape or something, then yeah, you would probably want to report it anyway. So that's another who's the victim, who's the perpetrator, who's a mandatory reporter. That varies. Sometimes that's defined in terms of an occupation, like a teacher, a counselor, a medical professionals. And sometimes it requires that person heard about it in the course of performing their professional duties. Church staff might be included, church volunteers, probably biblical counselors, clergy, that's another story in a moment here. And in some states, it's anybody. And you really wonder about that. What if you saw something in the grocery store or on the street? Are you supposed to call CPS? I don't know, but it's why some places wide open. And clergy, that's a special kind of thing. You don't want to assume that there's an exemption for a clergy. I mean, there's a clergy penitent privilege that applies to courtroom testimony or depositions so that a minister would not be required to testify to something that he learned about in a confidential setting. And that's very narrowly defined, actually. But that's a different kind of thing than the reporting. When there is an exemption, if there is, it's generally so narrow that maybe a Catholic priest would qualify because of that absolute church duty under the church doctrine to keep it confidential. But here, in this group, I think most of us believe in Matthew 18. Our religious doctrine wouldn't promote this kind of absolute confidentiality. And because of that, most likely there's not going to be an exemption. So just probably if you're a clergyman, you're probably not exempt. And then the other who is who should receive the report. Be sure you know that. Be sure you've got the phone number and the name of the agency and you know who to call when the time comes and you don't have to scramble and go searching around the internet or the phone book to try to figure out who it is. So who should receive the report? And that's where this resource with the 50 state laws and all the phone numbers and web resources at the end would help you to have something like that. Where do the abuse occur? Well, might be a church sanctioned activity, might be on the church premises, in the child's home. That's usually not as specific a thing in the state laws. It usually does, if you know a child's being abused, they're being abused wherever it is. But just be aware if something happens on your church premises, I would think there would be a higher level of responsibility to take some action than there might be if it were somewhere else. And then when, that's a real important question. When does the reporting have to be done? And as I flipped through these 50 states the other day to preparing for this, I noticed that many of them say, immediately. What does that mean? Well, sometimes it's 24 hours or 48 hours. In Connecticut, it's 12 hours. So if you hear about it at 8 o'clock at night, you're going to be up all night because you've got till 8 in the morning. And I noticed a case where there was a high school counselor in Arkansas who waited 14 days, which isn't a real long period of time, maybe, if you were trying to make sure that it was a reasonable suspicion. But that person faced a $2,000 fine and probation. So criminal charges. So this is pretty serious stuff. And then when did the abuse occur? That's another when question. What if it was years ago? I mean, if it was 50 years ago and the perpetrator has been dead for 40 years, well, maybe not. So that's an exaggeration. But if it was like 6 months ago and the victim turned 18 last week and the perpetrator is still alive and there's still minor children in the home, well then yes. So it's important to look at when the abuse occurred and to exercise some wisdom about it. There's a potential for lawsuits even years later if you don't report and you should have. Let's say that victim is 5 when you learn that there's a reasonable suspicion of abuse and that person gets to be 25 and they're in therapy and they suddenly find out that, oh yeah, you've been abused and that's why you're depressed and your pastor should have knew about it and should have reported it. You could be sued by that now grown child. Statute of limitations, sometimes it definitely doesn't start to run until the child turns 18. So you've got that period of time. And in some states, there's a discovery rule, like I just mentioned, so that if the child discovers in therapy that his or her problems were all caused by this abuse that happened in their childhood, that's when the statute of limitations begins to run. So it's really important that you keep good records with respect to any kind of child abuse incident in your counseling. And insurance policies, keep them forever. And be sure you know what your insurance actually covers. Your insurance may or may not cover if you're sued. Be sure you know what it covers. And so if you're sued years later, you might need to know what insurance policy you had at that time. And then how? How is the report transmitted? And the state laws will provide a specific process. Sometimes there's a hotline. There's usually a hotline that's available 24 hours a day. Sometimes you have to follow up with a written report after you make a telephone call. And you're going to have to provide some information as to who it is and addresses and things like that. There will be a designated state agency like Child Protective Services, maybe the name. Another thing that to be aware of is your chain of command in your biblical counseling ministry. Maybe there's a lead pastor, and there's maybe a pastor in charge of several biblical counselors. So even though each individual counselor may have a reporting obligation, it would also be wise, certainly, to be sure that your lead pastor that you report to is aware of it. It's just going to depend on how your counseling ministry is structured and where does the buck stop? Who has the authority? Be sure that the people that need to know about it. And if you can make a quick call to them, you can still fulfill your reporting obligation. It's often wise to have input from other counselors, other pastors, before you do that. But you still have got to act very quickly. So notify your designated leader. There are some states that will allow you to have a designated person to do the reporting, and then that person has the obligation. So again, know your state law. If they allow that, it might be that you want to designate the pastor who's in charge of your biblical counseling program. I have some friends in Raleigh that come to this conference, and I know they have a pastor that's in charge of their biblical counseling, and they bring a number of people. They've got several certified, ACBC certified counselors. So if that state allows you to do that, that pastor would be the logical person to designate to report. So again, some of them, there may be an online way to report and or telephone. So be sure you know how to go about doing that and what information you'll need to have. Know what information you're going to need to have so that you have it when the time comes. Why? That's another thing. Why is this so important? I mean, obviously, there's the biblical duty to protect the weak. That's certainly wise, to speak for those who cannot speak for themselves. But there's some serious legal penalties, both criminal and civil. I mean, criminal penalties can even be fines or imprisonment, which is kind of scary. And some of these laws are a little bit vague, like what is mental abuse? And criminal laws really are supposed to not be too vague. Sometimes they are void for vagueness because people need to have a reasonable idea of what they're required to do, especially with a criminal law that might put you in prison. But anyway, that's another story for another day. But the serious penalties. Some states have statutes that allow civil lawsuits against the mandatory reporter. There are 8 states, and that's on your outline. So you may or may not be in. I don't see Texas on that list, but legislatures meet all the time, and laws can change all the time. And sometimes courts create lawsuits that people can file. So typically it would be the victim versus the mandatory reporter, the person that didn't report. But when people file lawsuits, they tend to name everybody they can think of to name. And so they're probably going to name your church or your counseling ministry. So they're going to name other people. Now, if the church officials didn't know anything about it, they may be able to get off the lawsuit, but they need to have some good policies in place to be sure that they do know if they need to know. The laws typically have protections for people who report in good faith, people who have a reasonable belief that there's child abuse and go ahead and report. They usually can't be sued for making a false report if they acted in good faith. And they can usually report anonymously and ask that their name not be disclosed. But you, as a biblical counselor, as you're working with people, you may want to let people know that, hey, this is something I'm going to have to report. And if you want to be able to work cooperatively with the authorities to minister to that person and make their job easier too, you're going to have to talk to them about it. So that's something for you to consider and talk about in setting your own policies. Malicious reports are subject to liability. Not that any of you would do that, but if someone maliciously makes a false report, knows it's false, they're not subject to liability. But be sure you have a reasonable suspicion. And again, you know, pray about it, and because even if you're act in good faith, if it turns out to be false, it can still do a lot of damage to someone's reputation. So you want to really consider that carefully. Well,
since state laws vary, I hope this isn't a silly question, but I live in Colorado. Let's say I'm counseling somebody who moved to Missouri. We meet in Kansas. They tell me about something that happened in Montana.
Oh my goodness.
which laws should I be worried about?
Oh my goodness.
Any of them? All of them, maybe?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. You'd have to really, you might want to look at the laws of each of those states. My goodness. I'd look at where the counseling is taking place, certainly. I mean, your biblical counseling ministry is going to be in a specific state. But I know if you're near the border, you might very well be counseling people who are coming across the border. So if that's the case, that you're near a border, you might want to look at the laws of the state where your counselees are coming, this other state that you're dealing with that's nearby. Yes.
Yeah, just thinking, I don't know that it's so far because I know our fellows are supervising counselors all over the country.
Yes, they are. They are, yes.
So they can have people from all different states calling in. So.
They could. Well, the counselor, let's say, is in Colorado and is counseling somebody in Colorado and the ministry's in Colorado. That's going to be the law, and they're going to need somebody in Colorado, a lawyer, to help them, and they're going to need to know that state. But yeah, something could have happened in another state. And that's a good question, because maybe the perpetrator's in another state. Maybe it was a one-time thing, because most of these cases, and especially the states like North Carolina, where it's abuse by a caretaker, somebody that has custody, but it could be a case of divorced parents, and maybe the dad lives in Montana and the child lives in Colorado. So you might need to call, check out both of those states in that case. That would be a real wild question. Another good reason to have a family lawyer on speed dial. Yes.
I was told that the victim is the one that is reported to the agency. Is that correct?
Well, the suspicion of abuse, when you say the victim is reported, you want the identity of the victim, you'd want to give them that, and you'd want to tell them who the perpetrator is, with some addresses, look at what they want, but you're going to have to give them enough information so they can investigate. So if the perpetrator's in another state, you might end up having to report it there, because there'd be authorities there that would need to go out and check it out. That could be interesting. And that's where a good family lawyer would be really good to have, because maybe the parents have shared custody and they're in two different states. Well, the custody arrangement might need to be changed by a family court judge if the child's being abused by one of the parents. They may not belong with that parent unsupervised. So that gets real. That's a real interesting question. All right. Now, I've mentioned that there is a federal law. It really doesn't apply to biblical counseling, but there is a reason that I've mentioned it. There's a Protecting Young Victims and Safe Sport Authorization Act of 2017. That was passed earlier this year by Congress, but it was in response to allegations of abuse in the Olympics. It applies to athletic competitions, biblical counseling is not an athletic competition. But what's important about it is that it shows how important this issue is. And there's such an awareness of it. And some of the things about this law are helpful to understanding our responsibilities in other contexts like counseling. For example, there's the mandatory reporting. There are civil penalties for injuries. There are monetary damages, even punitive damages that are there by statute. The statute of limitations that starts on the child's 18th birthday goes for 10 years. That's a pretty long time. So that's until the child is 28. So that could be quite a long stretch. There are criminal sanctions, fines, and even imprisonment under this law. Immunity for reporters who act in good faith in making a report. Yes.
Are punitive damages always outside of your insurance coverage?
Probably so. Ask your insurance agent, but my guess would be yes. Insurance companies aren't going to want to pay punitive damages. And insurances often don't cover intentional acts. So if it's somebody like if somebody on your staff were abusing a child, they're not going to want to, probably not going to cover that. But a couple of things here that about the federal law that are important is there's required training. And that's important in your biblical counseling context too, to be sure all of your counselors and other church volunteers and employees who work with children should be trained and know exactly who they go to. They should know what the law is. So you need some training. And this little online summit that I mentioned on October 23rd, it's a seminar to train staff. Now, I don't know whether it's state specific or not. You want to be sure they know about your state. Policies. You need to have good policies or written policies. The reasonable suspicion standard is something that ought to go in there. Avoid having one adult with a child, and that's to avoid having abuse happen in your church. And that's in this context, this athletic competition context, that would be important. But like your children's ministries, it would be good to have policies like that. And review your policies periodically and make sure that they're being followed. There's some federal law that protects volunteers for nonprofit corporations. Follow the Volunteer Protection Act of 1997. And I'm primarily familiar with that in the context of nonprofit board members. A lot of times people are nervous about serving on nonprofit boards because of the possibility of legal liability. And sometimes people like to name every board, every member of the board when they sue an organization. So this has some protection in that context.
What year was that?
1997. And there's a proposed law to protect organizations. I mean, sometimes people even sue denominations. So I could see that happening. And usually the denomination, like in the Presbyterian Church, we have three levels. We have the local church, the Presbyterian, the General Assembly. Well, the General Assembly can't monitor everything that goes on in every church, nor can the Presbytery. So normally those higher up parts of a denomination, they're not going to be liable, but they have to go through the nuisance sometimes of defending a lawsuit and getting dismissed from it and saying, we didn't have any way of knowing about this. Well, those are the things to look for here, and a few other things that I want to mention, and then we'll see if there are more questions here too. Spousal abuse, that is a real important area, and it doesn't have the reporting requirements that child abuse does, but I mention it because if you have somebody, a case where, say, a wife is being abused by a husband, if there are minor children in the home, there's a risk there too. In fact, if that child is watching his or her mother being thrown against the wall or whatever, that could be considered mental abuse. I can see where that could be. So you want to be aware of that kind of situation. If it's spousal abuse, don't think that, oh, well, I don't have an obligation. That's what could be happening. And there are a lot of risks that could happen. Sometimes one spouse murders the other, or somebody commits suicide. So there's some real serious risks. And sometimes there's a duty to warn if someone makes a specific threat, I'm going to kill somebody. You may have a duty to warn that other third party. So there's some issues there. They're just not the detailed reporting requirements. And another kind of abuse that happens sometimes is the abuse of a relationship of trust, like a counselor and counselee. And that's another whole story where there aren't any minor children, but say a biblical counselor, hopefully not any of you, but sometimes there'll be a counselor and a counselee that becomes sexually involved, and the spouse of one of them sues the counselor or sues the entity that the counselor works for, the church. And those are very sad situations, and courts go a couple of different ways on that. Like, let's say sometimes a pastor will run off with a married woman that he's counseling and the husband sues. Well, some courts will say, you know, we're not going to get into that because we have two consenting adults. And some courts will say, no, this doesn't fall under the First Amendment because this is not part of a religious exercise. So maybe they will find some liability. So that goes all over the map. And church workers, a lot of this child abuse concerns applies to your ministries with children. There are issues like, do you want to employ somebody who has as a criminal record. It's important to do background checks on people that work with children. And so that's an issue for your counselors. You want to make sure who you're hiring to counsel and supervise them well. And this organization is good because of the training that it provides for your counselors, like this conference. And you want to have some good written policies for that too. I'm going to see if there's any questions. Yes.
Say you had someone who was going to work with you, go to you, and
they okay.
had been in prison before many years ago,
mm-hmm.
but it had nothing to do with sexual abuse or anything like that. What's your opinion?
Okay, somebody's going to work with your youth, older youth. The person was in prison many years ago, but it had nothing to do with sexual abuse and say had nothing to do with children. That's really going to be very case specific. And if you do let that person work, you're going to have some strong accountability. Because people can change, but it can get tricky. If it's been an offense that had to do with children at all, it's better for that person not to work with the children's ministry. Sometimes issues even come up with whether an ex-offender ought to be a member of the church. And again, there ought to be real strong accountability if you do. I mean, you want people to come to the Lord. You want to believe in change. And if the person seems to me, if the person has really repented and belongs to the Lord and has done this, they would be quite open to some accountability. If they object to it, that could be a problem. Red flag. Yeah. And one other thing here I mentioned is tort law. Every first year law student has this engraved in long-term memory. Negligence is requires a duty breach causation and damages. So you've got a legal duty here to report. If you breach that duty by not reporting and it causes damages, like the child continues to be abused over a period of time, you've got a negligence action. Even if there's no statute that allows a lawsuit against the mandatory reporters, this is where a court is likely to find that, yes, there is a case that can be pursued. It's a case of negligence. Yes?
I'm from Illinois.
Okay.
I have done some Skype counseling with an adult in Arizona.
Okay.
If my counselor had been a child and that there had been abuse issues,
so okay.
I follow Illinois law, since that's where I am at.
I would be inclined there, okay, for the tape. A counselor is in Illinois and by Skype counsels someone who lives in Arizona. And so is that where the abuse occurred, is in Arizona?
Yeah.
That probably would come under Arizona law, if that's where that child lives, because that's who would be investigating it. That would be my best guess. Yes.
Yeah, we had an issue similar that the counselee had been residing in another state, lived in our state, reported the abuse that happened in that state, but we still called Colorado, and they took the information but said we needed to call that.
Okay. Yes. Someone here is in Colorado, and the counselee had lived in another state, and that's where the abuse happened. Okay, and you called Colorado, and they said to call the other state. That makes sense, if that's where it occurred.
Mm-hmm. We run into things like that as well, because where people, we get a lot of 18 to 25-year-olds, and you get a lot of reports of abuse. If you contact local jurisdictions, a lot of times they will network back to the state of record, or the home state of record.
Okay.
You're still able to have.
When you say 18 to 25-year-olds, what context is that?
Welfare workers.
Welfare workers.
As we're talking to them through chaplaincy and things, sometimes you hear about the reports of abuse and stuff, and we're still obligated to.
That happened in another state. Okay, so the state where the abuse happened. That makes sense. Like if a crime occurs in a particular location, that's who has jurisdiction, is that the authorities in that state. So this would be similar, yes.
I think the only second that is if the perpetrator moved. So that's part of the investigation too. So if they are more in Arizona and they move to Minnesota, both states need to be notified.
Yeah, if the perpetrator moved. Yeah, and it would be a good idea to call both states and let them know. That's an excellent idea. Yes.
This is kind of specific. In Georgia, where in our church is counseling, the lady counselor, someone from not known to our church, she comes in for the first session, she tells our lady counselor that she was abused by the husband. So the lady counselor tells this lady, you need to report this. Report this. And so the lady leaves. We counsel before we get an intake form. And so we don't even have an intake form. All that the counselor has is the phone. And so we know the counselor before. What happens if something happens? How insulated is that counselor? How insulated is our church because of the he said, she said?
Well, this is in Georgia, but this is a grown woman who says her husband abused her.
Yes.
So we're not talking about child abuse here.
No, I'm veered off.
It's child abuse where there's such a duty to report. I mean, there, if it's a wife, you know, she's an adult. I don't know of any obligation that you would have to report that.
I think we have comfortable with that, but the fact is the lady said she didn't tell me to report. I didn't do it. I don't think it's hypothetical that someone would come back and say she got very poor counsel. She didn't tell me to do anything. So just love your folks. When in fact the counsel didn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
We're hanging out for a lawsuit.
Well, you're not there to give people legal advice. You know, this is an adult. You're there to give her biblical advice about it. So, you could tell her to call a lawyer, possibly, or report it, make a police report. That would be, if he's committed done something violent to her, it might be worthy of a police report. Yes.
We've been told by more than one state that in that situation or anything similar, the counselor has made good records in their notes. This
right.
is what I told the counselee. It might look like that's not very important, but it seems to hold up the law that they have a record of that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Keep good notes on what you've told people so that you can go back and know what you told the person. And yes.
The same rules apply for a child as elderly in most states when you're reading?
Well, elder abuse is another whole, oh my goodness, that's another whole thing. And I'm not an expert in that, but I know California has some real stringent laws about elder abuse. I'm sure other states probably do too, but in California there's elder financial abuse. There's all kinds of things that can be done there too. And not that I don't want to say one way or the other because I don't really know, but there are adult protective services just like there are child protective services. So it would certainly be a good idea, and it would be a good idea to find out that. I have not seen any comprehensive resources on that, but that's a very good, that's an important issue because there are elderly people who are abused in various ways, maybe neglect or... Yeah. And again, it depends on the relationship with a child. There's somebody that's got custody of a child. With an elderly person, some elderly people are under a guardianship or a conservatorship, and then there's somebody that's has legal authority that just like a parent would have over a child. The person may have given a power of attorney to somebody before they became mentally disabled. So that's there. It would be good to find an attorney that does elder law. That's becoming a specialty. That is a specialty in many states. Yes.
Can you define abuse versus using the rod and how people interpret that?
Well, yeah, I mean, where you might draw a line on that is you don't want to injure, you know, like leave bruises or injury. You don't want to use some kind of an instrument that's likely to cause an injury that's going to last. And of course, there's biblical admonition about that too. You want to do it in love and not rage. Yes.
I remember way back, I think it was Dr. Stone Good had a sheet on that that basically said teach your families to develop a policy. Written policy. This is how we deal
with a written policy.
Punishment.
Okay.
Family. We love a lot, we laugh a lot, we play a lot, we do all these things a lot. Down at the bottom, when we lovingly, carefully discipline and describe it. It's not
really
marks.
Right.
Whether you're angry or not. That was very good for me.
That's good, yes. I remember Bill Good from years ago. Yeah. So that's good. And for the tape, he suggested having a written family policy about, you know, we love a lot, we laugh a lot, and then we lovingly discipline when needed. So, yes. But in today's world, I mean, there are secular people who, maybe Christians too, who don't believe that, who believe any kind of corporal punishment is abusive. Yes. Some states will specifically say it's not.
Foster care.
They can't use it. Yeah, that's right.
Guardianship.
Yeah. Well, guardianship, I mean.
It's just like a parent.
Well, with a child.
A legal guardian.
Oh, a legal guardian. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. One last recommendation. I know Steve Viers is giving a seminar this afternoon at the same time, so he's just finishing up too. And he's talks about legal issues from a pastoral perspective. So I exchanged emails with him and outlines, and we're not duplicating information. But he has a good pastor's perspective on handling child abuse reporting. And I'm sure so would some others, other people who have been in charge of biblical counseling ministries. They're going to have some hands-on answers that I might not have. So I would highly recommend getting the tape from Steve Viers and listening to that too and hearing what he has to say, because it will be good. That will be good. I'm a mere lawyer here. But I appreciate your attention and thank you for coming.